Good morning. I'm speaking this morning with Stephen Johnson. He's author of a new book called Future Perfect, The Case for Progressives in a Networked Age. It's out now on Riverhead Books. Stephen is the author of quite a few books, bestsellers, including titles like Where Good Ideas Come From and Everything Bad is Good for You, some catchy titles. And the new book, Future Perfect, talks about a type, pure progressive, and what that type has, what that means for the future and how that's going to come into play. So I don't want to talk too much about it. I'd like to let Stephen talk about it. And so I want to thank you, Stephen, for talking to me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And I'm just going to start asking you some questions.
Good.
The first thing I'd like to ask you, at what point did the pure progressive type or model become concrete in your mind? And also, I'd like to know, you know, what do you refer to it as? I mean, I'm saying type or model. I mean, I don't know, how does it, you know, to what extent does it reach into somebody's life or into society potentially?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a political worldview or kind of a view of how you improve society around you. And it's basically making the argument that, you know, right now when we think about people's political worldviews, one of the things that we often do is we talk about, you know, the role of the state or the role of the private sector in the marketplace. And where you are on the political spectrum often, you know, is determined by the ratio of government to market that you think society should have. You know, if you're on the left, you want to have more of a kind of a stronger big government. If you're on the right, you want to have more of a kind of libertarian market-driven society. And what I'm trying to argue is that those aren't the only options, and that what we've come to realize over the last 30 years, in part because of the success of the internet and the web and a lot of technologies around us, is that there's this additional kind of institution that is what I'm calling the peer network, which is kind of decentralized, kind of open, collaborative networks without traditional kind of private property or market incentives, where people kind of come together in these large, diverse networks and solve complicated problems. You know, the internet was largely built with that kind of network. The web was entirely built with that kind of network. You know, Linux and Wikipedia were built with that kind of network. So we know it can be done. We know it's not some kind of, you know, radical utopian fantasy. And so the question is, with that kind of structure, with that kind of social architecture, what else can you do? What other problems can you tackle? And so a peer progressive is someone who believes that peer networks can be used in lots of different kind of parts of society, not just in building technology platforms, but in solving other kinds of problems. So that's kind of the philosophy. The story of how this idea came to my mind, it's in Where Good Ideas Come From, the last book, I talk about the slow hunch that people have, or an idea takes like a decade to form, and peer progressivism is exactly that kind of thing. I mean, I wrote a book about 12 years ago called Emergence, which was about decentralized networks that didn't have traditional leaders. But it wasn't really about politics. I mean, it was about, you know, kind of ant colonies and software and a little bit about cities and how city neighborhoods form. But it didn't have that much about, you know, kind of social interventions or, you know, how to improve the world. But, you know, a bunch of people kind of were inspired by that book and used it to kind of think about politics. The Howard Dean campaign, for instance, some of the folks there who planned their use of the internet were influenced by Emergence. And, you know, there were a number of other cases like that. So it was kind of this thing I was following in the back of my mind. And then when I wrote Where Good Ideas Come From, that was a book about innovation, and it was really a book about how often innovation comes from these open collaborations, and it's not always something that's driven by the private sector, or sometimes the private sector actually uses open collaboration to make better products and to ultimately be more profitable. And when I finished that book, I kind of realized that there were all these people around me who were working on these amazing projects in different fields, whether they were you know, in local communities, or they were thinking about campaign finance reform, or they were thinking about, you know, education. And they all seem to share this kind of core philosophy oriented around the power of peer networks. But no one was kind of, you know, describing it as a unified thing. We didn't have kind of a vocabulary to describe it. And so I decided to write Future Perfect to kind of give, you know, give that movement a little bit more of kind of definition. And really have the book not be a book of kind of abstract political theory, but to be a series of kind of stories that, you know, people could point to and be inspired by and hopefully go off and start their own things.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, what better way to argue for this idea than to offer some case studies in which, you know, this is basically happening. I mean, we're seeing success through this model.
And that's where the technology story is really important. I mean, I try to make it clear in the book that I'm not, you know, as they're sometimes called, I'm not a cyber utopian in the sense that I don't think that technology is in and of itself our salvation. The success of the internet and the web is really more of a kind of a role model for this movement. It's not the kind of core ingredient of it all. So we can now point to the internet, we can point to the web, and we can say, hey, somehow these things arose without being directly developed by either a corporation or a big government. Somehow they were kind of self-organized, and they work. And we now we have the situation where states and governments and corporations are hugely dependent on these platforms. And yet they came out of this, you know, self-organizing system.
Sure. So I that kind of in part answers another question I have. And I know that there are examples, you know, case studies, I guess, in the book in which, like, for instance, the 311 project in New York, where citizens can basically report issues around the city, and then, you know, this service basically ranks and responds to issues based on citizen input. Not necessarily built upon an internet service. I mean, it's a telephone service essentially, right?
Yeah.
So, but I guess, I mean, that's, I guess you, something you'd call technology. How does peer progressive, how does the peer network model still remain effective without, say, like the internet, or the technologies that kind of rally around the internet?
Yeah, well, there's actually a story that I just stumbled across that's kind of a lovely little example of it that's not in the book. But there was this guy, Mark Wakeman, in Portland, Oregon, who a number of years ago was, he lived in a kind of nice residential area in Portland, and he lived next to an intersection of these two streets, and it was like every little residential intersection in the country. It was kind of anonymous. It just was a place where two streets crossed, and, you know, it kind of belonged to the cars and the occasional biker, and, you know, you never would think twice about it. And then he went off on a trip, actually, to Central America, and he came back, and he was kind of inspired by this idea that, you know, throughout human history, crossroads have been kind of the center of civic culture. Like, places where roads come together is where people gather, and, you know, they have great kind of symbolic value in communities. And so he decided to like see if he could do that with his otherwise generic residential intersection in Portland. And so he got a bunch of his neighbors together, and he said, listen, I want to paint the intersection. I want to create a big kind of almost psychedelic looking you know, kind of image here that's going to take over the intersection, so it has some character and definition, and we can kind of like own it as a community. And so he actually went to the city, to the Department of Transportation, and they said, they had a classic kind of Orwellian line, which they said, you can't do that. That's public space. No one can use it.
Right.
And but eventually, actually, got the mayor heard about it, got kind of into the idea, and so he created this, painted this beautiful thing. And then the community started adding things to it. They put a 24-hour solar-powered T station, because it's a classic,
right,
Portland story. And and a little lending library for the neighborhood, and they would have kind of block parties where they'd gather on it and stuff like that. And then other neighborhoods started to get inspired by this, and so they started painting their intersections and adding little things around their intersections. And now it's become this movement called intersection repair, and there's an organization called City Repair that kind of encourages, you know, communities around the country to do this, to just, you know, create some character and definition in their neighborhoods. And, you know, it's just a light, slight little thing, but, it, you know, it's kind of a lovely story. And I think what's so cool about it is, it, you know, one, the government wasn't the answer. I mean, the government was trying to stop it initially. The private sector wasn't the answer. You know, it wasn't like they said, please, Starbucks, come build a, you know, a coffee shop on our corner. You know, if they'd done that, it would have had a different feel to it. You know, it was something that they, in a kind of bottom-up way, made happen, spread the word to other neighborhoods. And, it, you know, the most advanced technology was, you know, maybe the solar cells on the 24-hour T station. But, you know, mostly it was just paint.
Sure.
And I think that's a, you know, it's just a great model for how, you know, peer networks can work, particularly on the local level. I mean, I think that's where, whether it's 311 or it's painting your intersection, I think there's just a great, you know, already extant local movements trying to kind of tap the power of peer networks in their communities.
Sure. You talk a little bit about in the book about the private sector and you know the operation of a distributed or peer network inside of the private sector, and you talk about horizontal organizational structures. Intel, a good example of that. How does the horizontal organization structure play into the development of the idea? I mean, was the horizontal organization structure something that you saw and that kind of inspired you and kind of get made, you know, offered some validation for the peer progressive model, or kind of a sparking the idea kind of thing?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd always had this, really ever since I wrote Emergence, and there may even be a line about this in Emergence, I can't remember because I wrote it so long ago, but, you know, there's a wonderful thing about markets that, you know, that Hayek wrote about so powerfully and to some extent that Adam Smith wrote about, which is that they are, you know, decentralized in their decision-making. You know, that's why they perform so well, and that's why they outperform, you know, central planners, because, you know, no individual has to understand the totality of the market. The knowledge of the needs of the society, the economy is distributed through, you know, millions potentially of buyers and sellers and startups and producers and so on. So a marketplace is kind of a peer network in an interesting way, though it involves, you know, buying and selling and private property. But it's certainly decentralized. But the funny thing about that, while that is a crucial value in kind of the libertarian argument for why markets should be left to pretty much run as much of society as possible, the problem is that the corporation in its modern form is not decentralized. And in fact, a big corporation is, you know, one of the more top-heavy hierarchical forms of organization on the planet. I'm sitting here in Manhattan right now looking out at the, like, giant tower of Midtown, you know, and the, you know, the corner offices with the CEOs and, you know, and so you have this interesting thing where a market is, you know, very top-down inside the unit of the corporation, but very bottom-up in the marketplace itself. And so what I found researching this, book was this, you know, kind of interesting trend in a lot of companies, some of them tech companies, some of them companies like Whole Foods, that try to create, you know, flatter organizational structures, more horizontal organizational structures, you know, have, in a sense, a very little space between the kind of bottom of the chain and the top of the chain, and that's true both in terms of decision-making and kind of command and control and in terms of compensation. So they're much more participatory in terms of the decisions and in terms of the way that they share the proceeds from the firm. And, you know, a company like Whole Foods has all these really interesting, you know, they have these kind of team bonuses which can be shared with other teams in the store, what they call gain sharing, which is a pretty interesting thing. They have, you know, I think it's a 19-to-1 ratio from the, you know, kind of, no one can make more than 19 times someone else in the company, where the average is, it's in the book, but it's something like 300 or 400-to-1 in most American companies now. And if you go back and look at Intel and Fairchild and kind of the early tech companies, you know, one of the things that they did very early on that became a defining property of Silicon Valley was, one, they were more horizontal because they were largely founded by kind of peers of engineers. They got rid of all the kind of like big executive perks, and they instituted, you know, company-wide stock option plans, where the whole company would participate in the success of the whole company, which is a very unusual thing. We forget this now, but it's, you know, company-wide stock option plans were not something that most, you know, East Coast companies did in 1965 or 1970. And so when we try to figure out what was it that made Silicon Valley so successful, you know, there are a lot of answers to that, but I think one of them is that the companies themselves were less hierarchical, and they were closer to peer networks in the way that they organized information, made decisions, and shared the profits.
Sure. So more of a house next door than, say, like a house on the hill kind of thing, if you want to think about it in terms of a community.
Yeah.
And so that, I guess that leads me to ask, you know, we talked about, you know, the private sector, corporations, the public sector. Are there, do you think there are sectors in our economy, in our world, where we don't, where maybe a peer progressive approach would not be, you know, the most effective?
Yeah, I mean, I think there probably are, and I don't, you know, I'm this is a very optimistic book and a semi-utopian book because I think it's good in our public conversations to be reminded of the opportunities and the reasons to be enthusiastic about the future. But it's not a, you know, it's not as if it can solve every problem. Here's what I don't know and what I'm kind of curious about. The question is whether peer networks are capable of really long-term thinking. Now, this is a problem that marketplaces have, right, where they're pretty short-term, and one of the things that states do better is say, listen, we have to make a long-term investment in this, even if it's kind of not in our interest right now or it's hard to do, but we need to. We've got this long-term climate change problem, say, that, you know, is only really going to affect us 40 or 50 years from now, but we better start working on it now because, you know, it's not a simple problem to solve. Markets tend to think, you know, quarter to quarter, not on the 40-year scale. And I wonder whether peer networks, you know, would potentially suffer from the same problem. I don't know. On the one hand, there were some very, you know, kind of long-term visionary things that went into the building of the Internet, and that was partially because there was some government funding and kind of directives that were steering it a little bit. But there were definitely people working, not, you know, outside the government, collaborating on it, who made some very wise long-term decisions about how the architecture should be built so that other people could innovate it on top of it 10 years later or 20 years later, which proved to be crucial in the success of something like the web, which is, you know, built on top of the Internet. So it's been done, but I think there are clearly problems in society that need, you know, if you're trying to, like, fix a pothole on your street or build a new playground or do intersection repair, well, thinking on the scale of a week or 6 months or a year is fine for that kind of problem. But if you're trying to think about, you know, long-term energy needs, you know, 40 years out, you have to have a bigger, longer kind of vision. And I just don't know whether peer networks can do that. I'm not sure they can't. I just think that that's the thing I'm kind of most concerned about.
Sure. Some kind of hybrid between what we have now and as far as centralized intelligence and peer network for execution of problems.
Yeah, but that's exactly right. I mean, that's what 311 is. You know, there is kind of a headquarters of 311. It was instituted by the government. I've actually been to the call center. You know, it does have a kind of command center. But what it does is it creates a peer network of people contributing to the system so that anybody can call in and say, hey, there's a pothole on my street, or hey, I need this, or our neighborhood is lacking this, or there's a problem here. And so the center, the command center, gets much smarter because it has a decentralized network of contributors that are, you know, coming up with the problems and pointing them out.
Sure. So I know you're busy because the new book is out, but I want to know if there's anything that you've been reading lately that have been of interest.
I did a really interesting event the other night in New York, and with a bunch of wonderful people, Beth Novak and Clay Shirky, whose work was already very influential on mine, and both of whom are mentioned in the book. But it was also this woman, Tina Rosenberg, who wrote a book called Join the Club, which is about kind of positive peer pressure, which I had not read before I wrote Future Perfect. And it shares a lot of themes, and she's talking about it slightly different, and she shares the word peer. She's talking a little bit more about, you know, kind of local face-to-face groups, where there is kind of social pressure. But she makes this excellent point, which is to say, whenever you talk about peer pressure, and she would say, when she would tell people she was writing a book about peer pressure, everybody would just say, ah, yes, how terrible it is and how kids, teenagers are constantly, you know, coming up with bad behavior because of peer pressure. And she's like, no, this is a book about positive peer pressure.
Sure.
That you can use, you know, if you kind of allow the kind of desire to, you know, emulate and be respected by your peers, your face-to-face peers, or the people that you know, more intimately, if you can, through whatever mechanism, cause them to encourage good behavior, that's a really powerful tool. And that's part of the story of Future Perfect, that people get together and do these things without getting paid for it, which is kind of amazing. You know, people would build Wikipedia or, you know, support artists on Kickstarter without getting a traditional economic reward. But part of the reason they do it is they like to do it in public, and they like to see, you know, their peers see that they've contributed something and that they've, you know, been doing a, you know, kind of a positive service. And they do it for the social reward of it, which is a kind of peer pressure. So that's a great book. It's really been enjoying it. It's called Join the Club.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate you making the time to talk with me today. The book is called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Again, it's on Riverhead Books. It's out now. It is a great read, very optimistic, very broad in application. And I just want to thank you again.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate all the nice words.